Thank you, Dick. Thank you. Thank you. In case anybody wasn't awake yet, that was just to wake everybody up. Can I grab this and bring this over here, maybe? Is that all right? I got up at 5:15 this morning. We scheduled my flight especially early. We changed the times so that I'd have lots of margin and I wouldn't be late. And I walked through that door at 7:00. I was on time. No thanks to United Airlines.
What can we get you?
No, I'm covered. I did get my luggage, though. That was fortunate. I learned a couple weeks ago what Delta stands for. Don't expect luggage to arrive.
Did you get the boxes? Book boxes?
Yeah, but they're all here.
Okay. Once you explain that, you will have some literature.
Yeah, that's right. The luggage that I brought my own carry-on, but the luggage that I packed is books and materials, and I'll actually tell you about that towards the break time, and somebody's going to be working on getting some of that stuff out, and it'll be here tomorrow. I know that tonight is probably the easiest session to come to. Tomorrow's harder because you got plans and stuff, but I want to encourage you not to miss tomorrow, because tomorrow is going to be the most practical material that I know how to teach to help you as followers of Christ to make an impact in a non-Christian world. To be an ambassador for Christ, we have to know some things, and we're going to talk about some knowledge issues tonight that will hopefully give you some insight into some things that are going on. But you also have to take that information, the knowledge that our sovereign has entrusted to us about his truth, and also our knowledge of the community that we're going into so we can talk their language, so to speak. We also want to take that knowledge and be able to maneuver with it in a diplomatic fashion. And that's what tomorrow's sessions are going to be all about. And for some people, that's going to be a game changer, because I'm going to give you information that will make, well, people have told me, it has absolutely changed their life in the way they interact with other people about their convictions, about Christ, Christianity, truth, and other ethical issues or policy issues, the kind of things that you folks clearly are interested in. So I just want to throw out a little commercial for tomorrow and hope to see you there. Tonight, I want to talk, I'm thinking about it and we're coming in. Is there one word that I could use to capture the two sessions that I have tonight? In the outline that you've been given, the program, I'm actually going to reverse the order, because the reverse order is the logical order for my material. I want to talk about truth as a strange sort of fiction and from truth to experience second. But there's that word, truth. If you want to have an understanding in a kind of a simple way of what's at stake in our culture today, and I'm thinking principally for you as followers of Christ, but this has broader ramifications for policy concerns too. That one thing that's at stake is the issue of truth. That is the thing that is under attack. Now, I see a whole range of ages here. From young people, which I'm really glad to see you here, to gray hairs like me, or no hairs. So there's a wide range here. And back when lots of you and me were youngsters like these guys were, the world was a different world and people thought differently about truth. Everything's changed. And so anybody younger than 30 is going to be engaged with a world, especially those that are young adults, are going to be engaged with a world that does not understand the language that we use about truth. In fact, the word truth needs to be modified nowadays with adjectives like true truth or objective truth or absolute truth. Well, that was never needed before the 60s, because the word truth just did the work that it was supposed to do and people understood it. Now everything's twisted. And it's twisted principally because of a concept that you might recognize this term. If you don't recognize the term, you've been exposed to the concept, and that is relativism. Well, truth isn't one particular thing. Truth is whatever any individual believes for himself. Truth is relative to the individual. Now, I'm just tossing out some things to, by way of introduction to what I want to do tonight. Because relativism with regards to truth is the single biggest obstacle to the gospel. And not only is the culture deeply influenced by relativism with regards to truth, but the church is also deeply influenced by relativism with regards to truth. That is, it is becomes more and more the standard that young adults in the church are leaning towards the idea that Christianity may be true for them, but it doesn't mean that it's true for everybody else. Imagine if you said that about gravity. Well, gravity's true for me, but I can't say that it's true for everybody else. I mean, that would, obviously you're laughing. But this is the way people nowadays approach moral and religious issues, especially. Now, what I want to do in the first hour or so is to explain as best I can, give you a map of what is going on and give you a little feeling about how that is influencing the church, especially in a movement called the Emerging Church Movement, which I'm not completely against, but there are dangers there, just like the Jesus movement of 40 years ago when I became a follower of Christ. There was some good and there was some really dangerous, and we have to pick our way through this carefully. That there is no alternative anymore for Christians who want to be effective in culture not to be particular about the details. It's just gotten a lot harder, and that's the way of the world right now. I want you to think about something that Paul said in Colossians chapter 2. Paul said, do not be taken captive by philosophy, and unfortunately a lot of people stop right there, put a period there. And what he's saying, he keeps going. I've got an advanced degree in philosophy. It helps me to do my job a lot better. Nothing wrong with philosophy. It's not what Paul is after. Do not be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception according to the traditions of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. So what is Paul warning against? He's saying, be careful that you are not captivated, captured, taken in by a point of view about the world or reality that is not consistent with the way Jesus saw reality. Which means is not consistent with reality. Because Jesus saw the world the way it really was. So there's a warning by Paul that we are to be on the defensive. Look out, there are ideas out there that are hostile to the teachings of Jesus, and if you aren't careful, you might be taken in by them. So there's a defensive posture verse. I want you to jot down the second verse. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 11 and 13. Now here Paul is talking about spiritual warfare, but it's not the kind of spiritual warfare a lot of people think of. They think of like praying certain prayers and fasting and binding and loosing and casting out demons, and that's spiritual warfare. You go to a class on spiritual warfare, that's the kind of things you cover. That's not what Paul's talking about. Listen to what he says. The weapons of our warfare are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We got strong weapons. Then he says, we are casting down speculations. What's a synonym for the word speculation? Theories? We are casting down speculative theories and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Now hear me here. Paul is not saying that in this passage that we are to have pure thought lives. We are to have that, but that's not what he's talking about. He is talking about having thoughts consistent with truth. We are casting down speculations and lofty things raised up against the knowledge of God. Do you think we have some speculative theories, some philosophies of men that are in play in our culture right now that are raised up against the knowledge of God? Absolutely. Paul is telling us first in Colossians, be on the defense against those, and in 2 Corinthians he says, go on the offensive. You tear these things down. You show them to be the falsehoods that they are. So tonight, I want to start by talking about one of those false, if not the chief false ideology. And I want to introduce this concept, and I'm going to warn you in advance, it's going to be a little rough going for some of you. But I'm going to try to throw the ball so you can catch it, okay? I'm going to hold your hand and walk you through this. And if you get a little dizzy, well, okay, I understand. I want you to think about Hobbiton, you know, in Middle Earth. Now, if you were a hobbit in Hobbiton, you might have a conversation with one of the other hobbits about whether or not you saw an elf at the corner of the woods. Now, the other hobbits, you know, they might think that you were seeing things. After all, it was twilight, and you know, you maybe the line of sight wasn't that good. And you say, "No, I think I saw an elf." And they say, "Well, there aren't many elves in these parts. You know, those are out by the Misty Mountains. And you know, are you sure?" And so you'd have that conversation, but you would never have that conversation in this world, because in this world there are neither hobbits nor elves, right? There's one in every crowd, Dick, right? And so there's no sense having such a discussion. Now, if you, this illustration is meant to give you an idea of the move that is being made in culture. When I say move, it isn't like somebody sat down and thought this trick up to play on Christians. It's something that has developed over time, and people are socialized in a sense to accept this. And then if you go to university, you get a little bit more direct teaching about it, moving you along. But basically the move is the idea that the discussion among people about which view is true or not, whether moral view or religious view, is a waste of time, because there aren't any of those true things in this world. You say your Christianity is true. Some people say Judaism is true. The other people say Islam is true. This is as much wasted breath as talking about whether we saw an elf by the woodside, because there aren't any of those things. Now you can imagine right away how effective this can be for Christians who are taking the banner of truth that has been entrusted to them by Christ to the rest of the world. Back before the 60s, the discussion was who's right. And there's still some of those people left around, people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and the so-called new atheists. They're of the old guard. Most of you understand at least the way they think. But there is a whole new guard that's afoot, that is in play. And that's what these young people have to encounter. And that new guard is the group that just simply says there isn't any truth to even discuss. In fact, their take on truth is quite different. Now, they believe in truth after a fashion, but you have to understand what they mean by this. A number of years ago, I was lecturing at Berkeley. Big auditorium there at Cal, overflow rooms, had people. It was a great turnout. It was a Friday night and a Saturday night. After I gave a talk on relativism on Friday night, I opened the session for Q&A, and I had this great grand audience to interact with. And there was a young man who is a college student who raised a question, and it was the kind of question that intimated to me that he was thoroughly influenced by this death of truth mentality. And so I wanted to establish some common ground with him. And I said, "Okay, well, hold on just a minute. Let me just ask you a question so we kind of make sure we're on the same page here. The square root of 4 is 2, right?" Now, by the way, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's not right. You knew that, I know. I know you got a blank look on your face, but that's... So I said that to him, and all I'm trying to do is get a, "Yeah, of course, now we got common ground. We agree on some fact, we can work from there." He says to me, That's what my culture taught me to believe. And then he goes on to start talking. I said, wait a minute. We can't go any further here unless we get squared away on this one. That's what your culture taught you to believe? I said, yes, well, I know how you have, maybe you learned it from school, but you know what two means, right? Yes. You know what four means, right? Yes. You know what the concept of square root is? Yes. Can't you just see that two is the square root of four, regardless of where you first learned it? Can't you just see that that's, what's our word?
True.
And he said, that's what my culture taught me to believe. Now, I could not continue any more with this young man because we are now speaking, we are in, at least the conversation indicates we're in different universes. Now, in fact, he's got to live in this world, and I don't think he deeply believes this. But why is he saying this? Because he thinks he believes it. Because that's what he's learning at Cal. And every place of higher education in the country just about, except for Hillsdale College and Biola and a couple of places like that. Because this is what our kids are getting. Well, what is truth then? And let's take a moment to just define some terms. So I'm going to make a statement here. I'm going to give you a test. So you've got to pay attention to this. Because I'm going to offer you the meaning of truth. This is the classical meaning. It's not only the classical meaning, it's the thing that almost everybody means when they say the word true, but they're confused about it, so I'm going to try to get right to the heart of it today. I'm going to make a statement, and then I'm going to ask two questions, and the second question is more important than the first. Okay? And if any of you who are familiar with Stand to Reason have seen this illustration before, you can't play. All right? Okay, here's the statement. The pen is on the podium. I'm going to say it again. The pen is on the podium. Okay, now here's the first question. Is that a true statement? In case you... Let me just do it again. The pen is on the podium. No, is that a true statement? Okay. Yes, that's a true statement. I agree with you. Okay. Here's the question that's really the trick question. What makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, a true statement? Sometimes people tell me, well, I see it there. I get that all the time. I see it. Maybe some of you think of that. I say, close your eyes. Do you still see it? No. Is it still on the? Is it still true that the pen is on the podium? And I'm just going to stipulate I'm not doing any shenanigans while your eyes are closed, okay? So seeing it doesn't make it true, right? It may be the way you know it's true, but it isn't the thing that makes it true. Now, sometimes I hear people say, well, it's because I believe it's there. That's what makes it true. Okay, well, if you stopped believing it, would it disappear? Now, this is a very important point. Believing something doesn't make it true. If believing something made the statement true, then there is no difference between belief and make-believe. Between reality and fantasy, right? So those aren't the right answers. Here's the right answer. The thing that makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, a true statement, is a pen.
It's on the podium.
And a podium, and the first resting on the other. The thing that makes it true is something about the way the world is. Not anything about how I see, not anything about what I believe. The thing that makes it true is not anything about me. What if I disappeared? Would it still be true?
Yes.
Of course it would. This is the distinction. The thing that makes true things true are some objective feature of the world. Reality. That's called objectivism, by the way. But if you're a relativist, the thing that makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, true is whatever I believe. That would be my truth. Now, if you believe something different, that's okay, because it's not in conflict. That would be your truth. That's how all these religions could be true at the same time, even though they completely contradict. Now, there's a reason that people say this, and I have to give you a little, and I'll be gentle here, but a little philosophic background. And it's a very simple overview. It's true as far as it goes, but I could make it more complex, and there's more details to it. So some of you who know the details, I don't want to be accused of oversimplification. This is a good way of looking at it, a reasonable way. For thousands of years, people believed that there was a world out there. And that world out there could be discovered. And there were tools that we had in our possession to discover that. We had our senses. We had our intellect. We had our rational mind. We had our... and if you were a Christian, and actually most people back then were religious, they believed that God could also tell us something about it. So with the ancients, you had this concept of faith seeking understanding. Faith, that is, trust in what God's revealed in His Word about the world, and our ability with God-given capabilities, with reason and using our five senses, to figure out what the world's like. That's how science got its start. Science was started by biblical theists. Fundamentalists started the whole scientific enterprise, basically, because they believed that the world was made by an intelligent God who made it intelligible and gave us tools to do that. Well, about 200 years ago, that began to change. People started thinking, I won't get into the philosophers involved, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, some of you might know these names, but the names aren't so important, it's the concept. People started wondering, you know, am I seeing that thing? Or am I just seeing, like, colors or shapes? Am I seeing an impression of the thing? Well, when people started thinking that they were seeing not the thing itself, but just an impression of it, this is where Impressionism came from. This is when paintings got fuzzy. I mean, some of the fuzzy paintings are really beautiful. I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying that reflected our understanding. They're not painting reality as such. They are painting what they see. That's it. Just their sensory inputs. So there's a break now. The break is we're not in touch with reality. We're just in touch with something else. These people were called non-realists because the people who are realists were people who thought you could understand the real world. Well, even though they were realists, they were still modernists in the sense that they believe in reason and that kind of stuff. And then in the 20th century, things began to change. A lot of folks got really upset, tired of these modern rational folk who were taking over the world and using their power to manipulate and to destroy the environment and to enslave people and lots of ugly things. Plus, when you just, you know, the Enlightenment, they kept reason, but they kicked God out. And so with no God and just reason, that kind of a bare existence. And a shift happened in the thinking in our culture. And it really came home to roost in the last 15 years. And the shift was from modernism, like we're not sure about being in touch with reality, but we still have our rational minds, and there is no God, and man's the measure of everything, we're in charge, to postmodernism. And postmodernism questioned all of that stuff. They didn't want what those modernists had, with all their manipulation and all their imperialism and all of their narrow-mindedness. And they think they're right because they've reasoned it all through, and they have these empty lives and they're destroying the planet. And so a change took place in the thinking. And in the thinking, whatever we think is true, we only believe what we believe because our community, using language, has painted that picture for us. We believe in Christianity and in whatever it is that we believe in our community because we are all talking about it and our language creates this world for us. Think of it like Middle Earth. You know, we're in Middle Earth in a certain sense. Now, you can have another community across town and they have a different way of talking about the homosexual community. They have a whole way of different way of looking at reality. They have a whole different set of values. They're like, Narnia, in the sense that they're in a different narrative or in a different story. They're in their story, and their way of viewing things is true for them. Our way of viewing things is true for us, but you can't start saying that you got it right and somebody else got it wrong because you're stuck in your story. And that's all you can talk about is your story. So this is the new face of relativism. Are we in touch with reality? No, we're not in touch with reality. There is no reality to be in touch with, or if there is, we can never know it because we're stuck in our language. And so this is the kind of thing that is going to inform when you send your kids off to university and they try to persuade your kids that all of this stuff that they learned as true is not. It's just a story. And I don't mean a story like it's a myth in the Bible. Like, yeah, those are stories, those are myths. I don't mean it that way. What I mean is the way they view it is all reality or people's perception of reality is just a story. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the postmodern move. How do you talk to people like that? Because the minute you start acting as if your story ought to be everybody's story, they got a word to describe you. What do you think that word is? Intolerant. Narrow-minded, arrogant, nowadays bigot. Actually, they've got a lot of words to describe you. This becomes very, very difficult to maneuver because they are thinking so differently about the nature of the world. And this is why tomorrow's session is so important because I'm going to teach you how to maneuver in that. But it's not just the culture. It's the church. They are buying the same thing because this culture is pressing so powerfully on them with these issues. So I want to try to tell you why I think this way of looking at truth is is false. And I'm going to suggest a way of doing it that I hope makes sense to you. And if any of you may be tempted by this idea, because it seems really tolerant, it seems like, well, look at live and let live, right? What I want you to, if you're tempted by it, what I want you to see is, if you buy into this view, it is not possible for you to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying I won't let you be a Christian. What I'm saying is you will have bought into a philosophy that makes the kind of faith Jesus requires impossible. Now I'm going to explain that in just a moment, but I have four words I need to define. I want you to write these words down. Just leave space to write something after. Reality, belief, truth, and faith. Reality, belief, truth, and faith. These are terms that require precision for us and are deeply misunderstood. But it's not hard to get them right. Reality is the way the world is. That's all it is. It's the way the world is. I'm not saying I know the way the world is. I'm just saying it's the way the world is. However it happens to be, there's a world out there that's somewhere. You know, how many chairs in this room? That's the world, you know. Reality is the way the world is. The way things actually are. What is belief? Now, here I'm not restricting the word belief just to religion. Belief is the way we think they are. The world is. It's the way we think. I'm not saying you're right, you're wrong. I'm just saying that belief is a holding that a certain thing is true. The reality is a particular way. I believe there are lots of people looking at me right now. I'm not saying true or false. That's my belief. Everybody has beliefs, by the way. Chock full, not just religious people. Belief is the way you think things are. Now, what is truth? Truth is when you're right. That is, your beliefs match the world. When your beliefs match the world. If there are 127 chairs, if there are, as a matter of reality, 127 chairs in this room, and you also believe that there are 127 chairs in this room, then your belief is what? True. You see, it doesn't really add a lot to say it's objectively true or it's absolutely true. It's just true. You got it right. Now the trickiest one. Faith. Well, wait a minute. You just said belief. I thought faith and belief were the same. I'm going to make a little distinction here that's important. Because faith isn't simply believing something to be so. Faith isn't simply believing something to be so. Faith is when you act on the belief. You all come into this room. You see, you think you see chairs. You believe there are chairs. And based on your belief that there are chairs, you sit down in one. And it is not until you sit down in one that you exercise the kind of faith I'm talking about. Now, with seeing the differences in those words now, it may become, may understand a distinction you see sometimes in the Gospels and the New Testament, and also one that you can make in the church, that there's a difference in believing that something might be so and trusting in it. John 2 says, many were believing in him, but he was not entrusting himself to any of them because he knew what was in the heart of man. And in John chapter 6, after the Bread of Life discourse, a whole bunch of those jokers left him because they didn't like what they were hearing. They weren't going to sit in that seat. And what did Peter say when Jesus asked, are you going to leave? Peter says, where are we going to go? You are the one who has the words of eternal life. We're staying right in the chair. You see, biblical faith is active trust. Biblical faith is active trust. You must first believe that something is true before you trust in it. Believing that it's true is not enough. It's necessary but not sufficient. Now, I said something. Now, with those definitions in place, I want to make good on a promise here or a statement that I made earlier that for some people is really controversial, particularly those who are deeply involved in a broader Christianity that is sympathetic to postmodern views. This movement is called the Emerging Church Movement. It's actually died down a bit in the last few years, and I'm somewhat glad for that because of the dark edges of it. But that statement that I made that was rather bold is that if you do not believe that truth is objective, if you don't believe in objective truth, truth the way I just defined it, then you can't be a Christian. And boy, I've had people push back really, really hard on that one. How could you say that? I'm imposing something that the gospel doesn't require. It's only faith in Jesus. Well, slow down. Let me ask you a couple more questions. Here, this is the easy one. Does knowing the truth save you from your sins? Does knowing the truth? Right. You can know all kinds of medications for sicknesses. You can still die of a sickness, right? Okay. Now, that's the easy one. Here's the hard one. And I'm going to ask you this other question. I want you to think about it before you answer because it's a trick question. According to Christianity? I'm going to ask the question I don't want you to answer because I'm going to give an illustration to save you embarrassment, okay? Here's the question. According to Christianity, does faith save you? Don't answer. According to Christianity, does faith save you? Now, I didn't bring something because I thought I could be helped by the TSA that I usually have right now, and it's a little vial like of insulin, and it's a hypodermic needle. And so you just have to use your sanctified imagination. So I'm going to hold up the insulin. I'm holding up the hypodermic needle. I say, you know what this is, right? This is a hypodermic needle. This is insulin. If you are diabetic and you are going into like diabetic coma or whatever they call it, I mean, bad news when you need your insulin but you don't have it. Would you trust me? You may believe this could save you. This could, you know, do the. Would you trust me? Would you entrust yourself to me to inject you with this insulin? And I can always get a friendly audience to say, yeah, we trust you. And my response is, well, if you did, you'd be dead because this is not insulin, it's saline. So now I want to ask my question again. According to Christianity, does faith save you? If you took that insulin or that stuff from me, would you have expressed active trust in me? Would you be alive or dead? That active trust didn't save you then, did it? Does faith save? It does not. Jesus saves. Faith simply is an act of trust. It is Jesus who does the saving. But if Jesus can't save because it's not true that Jesus can save, because there is no truth, then you can't trust him in the way that he wants to be trusted. The writer of Hebrews puts it, without faith, it's impossible to please God because you first must believe that he is. And, of course, not written there, and he's got to be there. Because if you believe that he is and he isn't, that is, if your belief is false, you're lost. Do Muslims express active trust in Muhammad and in Islam?
Yes.
Do they? Wow. More than me in Jesus. But it doesn't matter how much faith they have if the faith is misplaced.
That's right.
Then it's not going to save them. This is the danger of Christians being tempted by the idea that there is no truth. Because if there is no truth, they don't believe that it is true that Jesus actually saves them. And that's what's required. You have to believe it and trust in it. If you don't believe there's any truth, then maybe you'll have some kind of religious thing that you do. But if you say, well, Jesus is good for me, but he's not necessarily for other people, because there is no truth like that, then you are not believing in Jesus the way Jesus requires you to believe in him. And there are lots of Christians that have bought into this notion, at least subtly. And that's why I'm trying to explain how dangerous that it is. Now, I'm going to give you two reasons why I think that this notion of truth, this postmodern notion of truth, or I should say this postmodern notion that there is no truth in the sense that we've always thought of it, is false. Okay, there are two reasons. One's a little harder. I'm going to give you the hard one first, and then I'm going to give you the easy one. Okay? When a person says that there is no truth, I could always ask the question, is that true? Now, that went so fast that some people think it's a trick. But it is not a trick. And when I say this to university students, they'll kind of do an, oh, that's, you know, you're just talking like a modernist, you know. That's not the way we talk. Well, I don't. It is the way you talk. Because you're talking to me right now, and you want me to. You're telling me your postmodern understanding of the world. And you're trying to persuade me of that. That's why we're having this conversation. You think I'm the narrow-minded, arrogant, intolerant one because I believe in truth. But you reject all of that. And that makes you kind and tolerant and open-minded. Okay, so now you tell me, what am I supposed to do with what you just told me? What do you want me to do? I think you want me to take it seriously, right? I think you want me to believe you. But what is it that I'm believing? I'm believing that you're right. Right? You are trying to persuade me that you understand the world correctly, and you are trying to re-educate me about the world. You're trying to set me straight. In other words, you're telling me what you think is true. Do you see the conflict there? Oh, this is called a self-refuting statement. It's like the person who says, I can't speak a word in English. Not a single one. With just uttering it, you realize they're running into a problem. Okay? It becomes false when the words come out of their mouth. And that is true. That is the case with the claim that there is no truth. I actually had a debate with a guy on this. I mean, a university professor, Marv Meyer. Now, Marv Meyer had a PhD in philosophy. He was an expert in the Gnostic Gospels. My Gospel of Thomas, my translation, is his translation. He was on all kinds of TV shows, the History Channel and stuff, all the time being interviewed because of his knowledge about these kinds of things. But I debated him at Chapman University in Los Angeles area. And I was a little nervous because, you know, he's got the PhD. I don't even have a master's degree in philosophy at that point. And he's got, you know, the big name. And we're at his university in front of his students at the student union there, you know. But I had one thing going for me, and that was the topic. The title of the debate was, Is Truth True? I thought, this is going to be easy. Well, at least solving the problem would be easy. Communicating it might be hard. And so, as I started out, I pointed out that this thing that I said here, you know, is truth true? I mean, there is no truth. Well, is that true? And that went over their heads because they're, you know, they're undergrads. Actually, the grads are worse, you know, the graduate students. So I said, you know, a debate is a certain kind of thing. A debate is a place where two people show up to take opposite point of view about something and to give reasons why their view is true and the other guy's view is false. Well, so if Marv Meyer just shows up for the debate, I win. Because you've got to assume the truth of my side even to have a debate with me. I said, when somebody says that there is no truth, this reminds me of the guy who I used to work with, and I was a carpenter for a number of years. And in Southern California, it's if you live on the coastal area, like where I did on the west side, you know, the wind blows all the smog inland onto Riverside County, and then those guys have to suck that up. But one summer, I was working in Riverside County as a carpenter, and it was really bad. And my buddy and out there were hacking and coughing and sputtering and going, oh my gosh, you know, this is... We're dying out here, and my buddy says, I can't take it anymore. This smog is killing me. I got to take a break. I'm going to go out back and have a smoke. You know, and he said it so blithely, like he didn't even realize the contradiction. So I'm telling this to the audience because I'm trying to go from all these different angles to help them to see. Marv Meyer is arguing that Aristotle is wrong and Derrida is right, that Kokel is wrong and that Marv Meyer is right, that he's got the truth. And the truth is, there is none of that stuff. So at the end of the debate, I had the last word, the way it worked out, and it was just before they were going to vote. So I said, you guys are going to be voting in just a moment for who you think won the debate. And I think Dr. Meyer did a good job, and I hope some of you vote for him. That's fine. I just want you to realize what you'll be saying when you mark your ballot that Marv Meyer won the debate. You will be saying that Dr. Meyer persuaded you that his view was true and my view was false, and therefore every vote for Dr. Meyer will be a vote for the resolve. Thank you very much. Good idea. And they all laugh because they got it. Every vote for him is really a vote for me. When they took the tally at the debate, Marv Meyer got one vote. Somebody wasn't listening. There are two other people who wrote a bunch of postmodern gobbledygook around the edges of the ballot because they didn't want to fall into the trap, but it wasn't a trap that I was setting. It was a trap because of the nature of reality, for goodness sake. The claim that there is no truth is false. And even God can't make that claim true. It's a contradiction. So that's the first and should be final argument against this claim. And it should be obvious to the whole world if you think about it for a moment. But there's another way to show. I call that committing suicide. The argument commits suicide. But there's another reason that the claim that there is no truth is false. And this is the easy one. Here it is. Because we each know truth. K-N-O-W. We each know truth. We are truth seekers by nature. We are constantly looking around, assessing, even though it's not always conscious. We are taking things in, making assessments, trying to figure out what's true and what isn't. Can that chair hold me? Is there a step right there? I'll just go right up. Now, we don't say that consciously, but all the time we're making the... Hey, look, how many people are here for the very first time? Let me back up for a minute. This is the first time you've ever been in this location. Just raise your hand. Okay? So how did you get here? I don't mean how did you arrive. I don't mean how did you... What's your locomotion? I mean, how did you know to be here? How did you get here? Did you have a map?
No.
Did somebody have directions? GPS? What? GPS. And all of the above? Any of them. What is a map? A map is a piece of paper that makes a claim about the way the world actually is. Right? GPS does the same thing. It's like there's the road, there's this. What are you doing when you use a map? You are taking a claim about the world and you are matching it up to the world. When you take a claim, a belief about the way the world is, and you match it and find out that's the way the world is, that's called truth. And you drive and you arrive. If you got here today using a GPS, a map, or directions, that's evidence that those directions were true. That's just a simple little illustration. But you do that 1,000 times a day without even thinking about it. In fact, if you couldn't know at least some things are true, I'm not saying that everything you think you know is true. We make mistakes. But the postmodern claim is that we can't know anything to be true. All we have is our little stories. And if you couldn't know the way the world was, at least in some things, you'd be dead in a day. Postmodernism is just simply false. And once we start being tempted by that stuff without realizing how poisonous it is, it begins to undermine everything that's important. Now, I want you to notice something I did not do. I am not saying, stay away from that poisonous postmodern stuff because, man, that will ruin your faith. What I'm saying is that I argued that the postmodern view was false. And I gave you two good reasons to know that it's false. And I'm encouraging you not to be taken in by the appeal of it, because when you go out there in the university or wherever and people are talking about it, they're assuming this to be the case, and they make it sound so great. They make it sound so appealing. They make it sound so tolerant. And so we get pulled in because we don't want to be bigots. We don't want to be intolerant. We don't want to be nasty people. We want to be liked. And I understand that. But I want you to notice what's happening when somebody calls you intolerant. Whenever anybody calls you intolerant, you always want to ask a question. And the question is, what do you mean by that? Now, when I ask that question, I'm looking for more information from them. That is, why are they calling me intolerant? What am I doing right now that they think qualifies me for the phrase intolerant? What's going on here? So I'm not going to, oh, well, you're intolerant too, or you're ugly, whatever. Yeah, I'm not going to just... No, this is a tactical move here. So what do you mean by that? Now, I know what they're getting at, but I want them to say it. Here's what they're getting at. They're annoyed because in my conversation, maybe I'm talking about spiritual things. And I'm talking about Jesus as the Messiah and as the only way of salvation. And that bothers them. And I understand that bothers them. I'm sympathetic to that. It bothers them. Bothers me too. Peter said it was a stone of stumbling and the rock of offense. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised when people get annoyed by that. But notice what happened. He's bothered because I think I'm right on that point. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think that I think I'm right when I talk about something I believe? Mm-hmm. Of course I think I'm right. If I didn't think I was right in what I believed, I wouldn't believe what I believe. I'd believe something else. And I think that was right. Just like everyone else. And that's the key. I am not the only person in this conversation that thinks I'm right. That other guy thinks he's right too. But I'm the only person getting beaten up. Called names, that is. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm using this phrase called names advisedly, because isn't that exactly what he's doing? First we're talking about Jesus, then he says you're intolerant. Does that have anything to do with the discussion about whether Jesus is the only way or not? No, that's an attack on me. What if I turned around and said to him, "Then you're ugly." No, I wouldn't do that, but can you see that that's kind of the same thing? He attacks my character. I attack his looks. Are either of us talking about that other thing? No, we've changed the subject. Now we're just attacking each other. This is what passes for tolerance in our culture. Mm-hmm. We're the tolerant people. We're going to beat you up and call you names. Now, when I ask, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, you think you're right. I acknowledge, I do think I'm right. Then I ask him another question. This is kind of the spring the trap. But again, this is not illicit. I want him to see something, and I want you to see it too. Do you think you're right? That's the question I ask him. Do you think you're right? Now, what's he going to say? That he's dead wrong in all the things he believes? Of course not. He also thinks that he's right. Now, he might say, well, I'm right for me. I said, well, if you're just right for you, why are you talking to me right now? Aren't they trying to persuade us in those circumstances? Yes. So my final question is, why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right? What am I missing here? Of course, I'm not missing anything. This is the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. And what's going on here is these are the folks who think they believe in all this postmodern stuff, and that makes them warm and open and tolerant. But you cross them, you disagree with them, and what do? They go right after you. And they go after you with a passion in many cases. So it turns out that these people who are posturing and appealing to our young people with this tolerant postmodern approach are not tolerant at all. They all think exactly alike, and they welcome everybody that's just like them. It's not the university anymore. It's just the uni. There's not unity and diversity. There is no diversity. You know what they think is diversity? Different kinds of sexual behaviors. There is no diversity in ideas. If you stray from the path of ideas, they're going to have a pound of flesh from you. So I'm trying to disrobe this whole thing for you guys to see it for what it really is. This whole attack on truth, and it's done by lots of people who don't know any better. Like I said, they're taught this, they're socialized this way, they get called intolerant and arrogant and narrow-minded if they don't play along, and so then they go along. But where does that leave the Christian standing? All alone. Now, that's not a bad place to be when you're actually not standing all alone, you're standing with Christ. But it makes our position awkward. And so what I've tried to do this first hour is just to give you a little picture of the landscape to see, that's what's going on and what's wrong with it. And especially for the young people here, that if they've been drawn in by this thing that looks attractive, this diversity tolerance thing, I just want you to know that it's not diverse at all. Where is the Hasidic Jew in that group there that gets his equal say in everything? Where is the jihadist Muslim? Well, actually, they might be there. Now I think about it. Where is the evangelical, or one might call fundamentalist Christian? Do they have equal play in these discussions? Where's the person who thinks that same-sex marriage is not a good idea? Where are they allowed in the game? You know? Oh yeah, we welcome you. We want a diverse ideas. Oh, you think homosexuality is wrong? Oh, come on down. We want to hear about it. Well, you know this isn't true. It's just smoke and mirrors. So I've covered a lot of stuff here. And like I said, for some of you, maybe it was a little bit painful. But the culture is really confused about truth. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be.
That's right.
The concept of truth is real simple. If your belief matches the way the world is, well, then it's true. We've got some tools that we always use to figure out truth in the world. And I think those kind of tools can be applied to spiritual things and moral things just as well as anything else. And that's a lot what we do at Stand to Reason. I don't want you to be intimidated by the opposition, though. And I'm going to give you a piece of homework for this first session here. It's Matthew chapter 10. I've been spending a lot of time in Matthew 10. Matthew 10, Jesus sends out the disciples for a short-term mission. Now, I'll just close with this illustration, then we'll have a break. And he gives them a warning. He says, here's what you do. And then, by the way, it's not going to be easy. And then he explains, I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword, to set family against family and brother against brother. And but I've warned you in advance. I've warned you in advance. So this is for us right now, not just for them. Mm-hmm. Behold, I warned you in advance. Do not be surprised when you run into this opposition. Right. And it will be fierce. And some of you know already. But Jesus says in this passage, you find it and you mark it three times. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. He who confesses me before the Father, I will confess before the Father. I should say, he who confesses me before men, I will confess before the Father. And he who denies me before men, I will deny before the Father. I think that's enough for the first segment. Dick, thank you. Thank you.